Okay. I seem to be ready. I hope you are, too. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock on this Thursday, the 23rd of April. Very nice to have you with us, as it always is. We love having you. We love getting together. We love talking and finding out what's going on in our world and doing it with such a wonderful panel. Let me introduce everybody to you, and we'll get started. A reminder that you, too, can join us. It's more fun with you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel, at least sometimes it is. Panel at WAMC.org. And WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Chief. I'm great.
Good to talk to you.
I'm great or not.
Yeah. How did the media project go? Is that all right?
The media project was just fine. We have several really great stars, including our Rosemary Armeo and Rex Smith and, you know, Judy Patrick, and it's just an incredible group.
They just came from that taping, so that's why I asked that question. So that's right. That's fantastic. So thank you very much. Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist, and, of course, a UAlbany adjunct professor. Good morning. How are you? Hello, Rosemary. Are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can now because, to do this, you have to press a button, and I didn't do that. So now that I have, I can hear you. It's all on me.
Terrific.
Good morning.
Okay, good. I love when it's not my fault.
Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics Vera Acarius-Kelly joins us. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing really well. Glad to be part of the show.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We always love when you're a part of the show. Corporate attorney and our good friend Rich Honan is here. Good morning, Rich. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
We're well. And I thank you for being with us. It's really nice to have you on the program, as it always is. All right, so let's get started. I'll admit, while I was doing that, I was sort of doing the scrub down of the studio, which I normally would do earlier, but because of a scheduling conflict, I didn't get full time. So I just want to make sure we're all safe and here, and that the studio adequately smells like bleach. So we're it's just not the same without that bleach smell. All right. Good morning, everybody. So I guess the big story, of course, is one that just happened. We now know that in 5 weeks, 26 million jobs were lost. The number of people forced out of work during the coronavirus lockdown keeps soaring. Last week, 4.4 million people filed for jobless benefits, boosting the total since last month to 26 million. That was reported this morning. Alan, what do we make of that, of putting that into concept? I know Marketplace, right before we came on, was saying that every job that we added during this growth period has now been lost.
Well, from a political perspective, it's terrible for the president, who had been counting on the fact that this thing was that the economy was going to be what got him reelected, and that isn't going to happen now. We do know that the Congress and the president made a deal where you got money for your small business if you didn't fire anybody, and still you have 25 million. Is that what it is, Joe? People.
Yes, correct. 26 million in 4 weeks, 5 weeks, excuse me.
That's unbelievable. People filing for unemployment, and that would not speak well for his electoral chances. So he has to go to other places. And we know what some of those will be, including his usual divisive ploy, firing people who are in charge of his major medical program to come up with some kind of a cure or a preventative. So that's where it is. There's a huge political background to this.
Rich Honan, what do you make of it? 26 million people out of work, 5 weeks.
Yeah, it's awful. I was trying to get, did you get a percentage on that, Joe? In other words, what percentage of the workforce is now out of work?
Yeah, that's a great question. I can look it up.
I was trying to find it myself. And I mean, the Great Depression was 25%, right?
Right.
It's awful. It's the question's going to be, you know, once this ends, whatever that means, what percentage of those people will be able to become at least partially employed, and how long will that take? And, you know, that's a scary thought. I mean, a lot of those jobs are held by people in places that may not have customers or patrons for a really long time. Whenever all this ends, you know, the whole question of, are people going to go into restaurants, are people going to go into malls, at least right away. And so it's a scary thought.
Vera?
Yep. In addition, I wanted to say I agree with what Rich said and what Alan said, but we also need to think about larger questions in terms of completely rethinking how our economy will work, because it looks like this time around we have a lot of people who lost their jobs who actually could be doing part of their work from home. So we begin to see massive layoffs in executive teams related to media outlets, IT firms that don't need certain sectors anymore, management areas that might not recover very fast or ever at all in terms of large retail operations. So we see people beginning to lose their jobs that we thought were sort of more in the white collar, more highly educated arena. So this adds to the larger conversation of what the path forward might look like and how we need to conceive returning to opening certain businesses and how long certain sectors will take to recover, if ever.
So, Rich, to your point, according to the Labor Department, this brings the cumulative unemployment benefits claims to more than 26 million, as we mentioned, representing about 16% of the labor force.
Wow.
The economy created 22 million jobs during the employment boom, which started in September 2010 and abruptly ended in February of this year. So 16% is the number that we're dealing with right now. Rosemary Armeo.
Well, this is such a period of dislocation and damage. It's comparable, when I look back in history, to the Hoover and the oncoming depression. And he was a man. He was actually a good man. He was an organized, smart man, but he lacked imagination and he lacked boldness. And so he fell into a decline. And while you could say the depression was not really the fault of the president, he was certainly and rightfully blamed for it. And I think that Trump is falling into the same thing. We took action that threw people out of work. It's not the same as a depression, that it happened inadvertently. We did it on purpose and for a good reason. And a smart, bold man, I think, would be embracing that, saying we had to do it, and here's how we're going to recover and come up with a plan for a phased-in return and for restructuring and deal with automation right now and all those other forces that are all coming to bear. If we had a concerted bunch of smart people looking at this, it would be very exciting. Instead, it's just unadulterated scariness. People are worried that they are going to starve. We're looking at stories about world famine, and this should not be happening. It's not like anything happened to the economy. There's an epidemic that required its shutdown. We didn't lose anything.
Well, but it is, Rosemary, that something did happen to the economy, and it's on the demand side, right? I mean, much as we don't like to admit it, we're a very consumer spending driven economy. And when you take away that supply or that demand, it's hard to replace that. I agree with what everybody said about, yes, this will change the way white collar people work, but lots and lots and lots of those 26 million people are people who cannot work from home. You know, if you work in a restaurant, you can't work from home. If you're cleaning the rooms in a hotel and there's no one at the hotel, you don't have work. And so a lot of this is going to be driven by consumer spending. And the question is, where is that demand going to be?
So on that note, I wanted to say it actually, consumer spending, of course, is essential for this country. However, that is directly related to consumer confidence. And you cannot have consumer confidence unless you increase testing dramatically in this country by million more tests each day to affirm that there isn't sort of an upswing in infections and a late response to it again. In addition to that, of course, we need to think long-term how we get the proper PPE for all people in the service industry. So, you know, we need to become a mass society like we see in many countries in Asia. So those questions related to consumer confidence need to be directly related to public health policies and preparing the population for how to stay safe.
You know, again, I go back to my idea that there's a shift and it's a deliberate action by humans that alter the economy. It's not something that without control could be good things. That new testing, new PPE, new manufacturing, those are all business opportunities. And if there were coordination and a look at this from a macro level rather than just get back to work, we need the economy up and running again so that it looks good in November when people vote, which is what's coming from Washington, we would be in a much better situation.
Alan.
Well, you know, there's really no way out of this. It's a mess. We have this virus. We have all of these people. We have all of these people, Joe, who are you know, desperate to go back to work. We have clearly the Trump people and their allies trying to get these small groups of people to protest outside the, you know, the state capitals and to do all of that. We have Trump, who is extraordinarily saying to the governor of Georgia, you shouldn't have done that, when he was the one who prompted him to do it. In other words, to open things up again, because he's looking at polls also. We're at a very bad spot in our American experience. Very bad.
I just have to ask, because you brought it up, Alan, but does anybody think that the governor of Georgia will eventually give in?
Yes. Many people will have to decide first.
Okay.
I would guess as soon as public health officials identify that there's an upsurge in infections, which of course can only be done if there's more testing in Georgia. Georgia has a very low number of testing. I think it was 1% of the population has actually been tested, which is incredibly low for an area during a pandemic. Even though when you think about Atlanta being one of the places where some of this country's premier hospitals and researchers are located, it's such a confusing reality in the state of Georgia.
I was hoping that it would happen prior to Friday, but go ahead.
Well, but how many, you know, on the testing issue, you say 1% is low. How many people have we been able to test nationwide? The last number I saw was something like, over this entire time, we've tested something like 4 million people. And what is that? Somewhat over 1% of the population. I mean,
yeah,
it's a
Rich,
massive
you're right. This
endeavor.
This is terribly low. This is terribly low in comparison to all countries that have managed this infection more effectively. When you look at Scandinavian countries, with the exception of Sweden, if you look at Germany, Austria, if you look at South Korea and Singapore, they have tested percentage-wise closer to 10 or 15% of the population. So we
that's
have to
not
look
correct.
At percentage of population. Oh, yes. You have to look
Vera,
at
no, that's the, that, that's not it, that's not a correct number. The latest numbers I saw were even in places like South Korea, which had the highest percentage, you were well below 10% of the country. I thought you were looking in Norway, you were looking at 2.5% or something. But even if you get
to
10%, I'm sorry, Rosemary. Okay, let's say we get all the way up to 10%. What does that tell us? I don't understand how that makes a dent in it. It only takes one person, right?
Well, right. So, I mean, but back to the question of, so does the governor of Georgia cave?
Yes. Can I get back to that?
Yes.
I think we're off track on testing. I think Vera is absolutely right about it. But it is not going to take testing even 50% of the population to bring an outcry. As soon as you have refrigerator trucks outside Atlanta hospitals, the way you did in New York, there'll be media and outrage from the health community that's going to be pressure on that governor to change things, if indeed that happens. I think that they're taking – we're yet to see – if people go along with it, are people really going to go and get their hair cut and get massages and risk infection for the sake of a little luxury? Is that going to happen? We don't know that yet.
But don't you all see what this is about? This is a political president who wants to get reelected, who's doing his best to sow discontent, and I want to use a word that won't get us fined $350,000, and the guy who is the governor of Georgia salutes and says, "Okay, boss, whatever you say," and then of course Trump double crosses him. He's looking at his numbers and saying, "This ain't good," and so I don't agree with him. That's unbelievable.
I mean, and there is the other thing, too, that and Alan, you're absolutely right. I mean, he's sort of stoking the flames, but then the retreat came, but you're not following the orders that we put forward, which they're not. And I just don't know. I'm interested in what Rosemary was saying, because that idea of, right, how many people do go along with it? I mean, we talked about this yesterday, and we see beaches full. We see things that are people are doing things. Do the same people who show up at the rallies, even though I know, Rosemary, you think those numbers are somewhat inflated by the media. Do we see some effect, and at what point does that turn out to be a tragic mistake?
Yeah, I mean, I think the governor is taking a huge gamble there, opening up and hoping that he'll get a resurgence in the economy that will outweigh the possible uptick in deaths and illness. But I don't know. I saw those pictures from Jacksonville where they opened up the beaches. They did not look full to me from my experience with Florida beaches. I don't think people are. They're afraid and they want the economy open again, but there's still social distancing. Even the protests in Albany yesterday, people were in their cars. They think that this is a hoax, that they're not going to take care of themselves.
All right.
Does anybody else think that?
Well, we're gonna wait for a response on that because we have to take a break. But when we come back, we'll hear it, and we'll go to letters as well. We have quite a few, and folks are anxious to talk about this and other topics, so we will do just that when we come back. We have Rosemary Armeo, Vera Carius, Kelly Rich Honan, and of course, Alan Chartok here. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Vera Acarius Kelly, and Rich Honan. Thank you all for being here. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. When we left, Rosemary was asking a question to the rest of the group of what they thought about this idea and talking about reopening. Alan, what do you think?
You know, the idea of a reopening is just stupid. The governor said so, and he's right. On the other hand, I must say he's being very cautious. So what he's doing is he's appointed Kathy Hochul, his deputy, his lieutenant governor, to be in charge of the Buffalo region, thinking that the Buffalo region would come along faster than New York City, and so we can divide New York State up into three separate states and have different people. He's got his former lieutenant governor being in charge of the Rochester area, and he'll be in charge of, downstate. But when he comes to the logic, he says, people dying is what this is all about, and we don't want people dying. And he goes after the so-called protesters, who I still think are an organized group of the right-wing president and his acolytes. That's what I think.
Rich, what do you think?
I'm glad to see that the governor has, it seems to be moving towards approaching it on a regional basis, kind of a microcosm of what the federal government is doing, is allowing people to approach it regionally, because it seems like, obviously, the harder hit areas are the more congested, urban areas. I mean, what's going on in New York City and its environs is just tragic. And then look at the numbers upstate. If you define upstate as, basically north of Westchester, you're looking at something like 10% of the numbers. So obviously,
I always think Yonkers, Rich. it starts outside of the Bronx.
There's a point somewhere in New York State where they put both ketchup and mustard on hamburgers at McDonald's, and that's like the dividing, because downstate it's just ketchup. and that's the dividing line.
All right.
But to Rosemary's point, I think look, you're right. No matter who opens up the gates, it's not going to be the floodgates. But Rosemary, I think that you need to have some governmental imprimatur. Some government somewhere has got to say in some limited way, okay, now you guys can start venturing out. And then I think people will slowly, begin to, gain comfort. There'll be some community of people that just doesn't, high risk and things like that. But I think you need a government somewhere to say, okay, you could start doing this.
Rosemary?
Well, I think, Rich, you're right. I mean, in many ways, we have to figure out what the next steps are. They have to be planned out very carefully. They have to be particular targeted industries, perhaps, that begin to think about how to pursue opening up. But most importantly, I think, protective measures have to be put in place so that when employees are asked to return or, let's say, forced to return because, they can't refuse to return to their work unless they want to lose their jobs and be replaced. So in essence, they have to feel confident that the measures put in place keep them safe and they don't carry the virus back home and infect their parents or whoever else lives with them or is in their immediate neighborhood. So the most important aspect about this plan to return to work has to involve public health measures and the ability to figure out when a localized outbreak can be identified and mitigated immediately so that a whole new wave of frustration, fear, and lack of trust doesn't negatively impact efforts to reopen aspects of the economy. So the plan has to be very targeted and has to involve a lot of layers of public health officials and immunologists to determine the path forward.
Rosemary?
One of the reasons that it's a shame that Trump is in charge right now, because he says it's safe to go out. I'm not believing it. In fact, as you're talking, I'm trying to think of who I would believe when they said, yes, we've reached a point where the planning and the safeguards are in place. We think you can go out. And unless it comes from Fauci, man, I'm staying in the house with a mask on.
Well, that goes back to your earlier point, Rosemary, of even in Georgia, how many people are actually going to go out and do this stuff?
Rich's point is right. Some people have no choice. I have men outside.
Right. Well, you have a choice of whether you go to a masseuse or not.
Yeah,
exactly. I think masseuses are probably not going to benefit.
Yeah, but Joe, you don't have a choice if that. You don't have a choice if that's your job.
That's correct. Yeah.
Everybody has a choice to go to a restaurant. Everybody has a choice to go to a beauty salon. But if that's what you do for a living,
absolutely,
you have far less of a choice.
Correct.
And that's going to break down upon really, really sharp economic lines.
And it's also going to be up to independent owners who are going to say whether they're going to open or close, and it'll be on them as well.
Yeah, but they
sort
need
of like if.
Okay, let Rich go. Go ahead.
But they need for if you're an independent owner. I keep thinking of the restaurants. I just think of all the local restaurants.
Right.
All the that through no fault of their own, just overnight put out of business. And with no real end in sight. But if somebody tells the restaurants you could open on a limited basis, I'm really confident they will figure whether it's 50% seating, whether it's your waiter wearing a mask, whether it's because they have to make people feel comfortable enough to come in, so they will experiment with that. And you have a really good. You have kind of a really good control there, because if people aren't comfortable with whatever efforts you've taken, they're not going to come into your restaurant.
Okay.
Yes, I agree with Rich.
Hold on.
Okay. Go ahead, Vera, and then Rosemary.
Okay. So I just wanted to say quickly, there was this really interesting study released by the CDC on the table settings in China. An air conditioning system was now identified as having spread the virus, even though people were you know, at a fair distance apart from each other. People don't wear masks when they eat. Now the worry exists with this air conditioning situation. So perhaps outdoor seating widely spread out might work. But even those kinds of concerns are emerging now as we learn more about this virus. So I don't think it's sufficient to push restaurant owners into making those decisions. Those are larger public health decisions. Go ahead, Rosemary.
Well, I was going to say, Garen, I'm sorry to interrupt. It's hard to tell without the visual cues here. I don't mean to talk over you, but to continue that, I think the two businesses that will face the biggest adjustments are nursing homes and private prisons, because you can't have them anymore.
All right. And Alan?
Well, you know, I gotta tell you, this is perplexing because, for example, the latest thing we heard was not air conditioners, but before that, right before that, was bats. I don't know if any of you have ever had a bat in your house. We have, and when I have a bat in my house now, I'm going to freak out. I never liked the things anyway, but if in fact the bats turn out to be the transmitter of this thing, you know, the reliability of, my point is, the reliability of the information is not very good. So there are a lot of theories, we just don't know.
We're going to take a break. There's a couple of technical issues we want to take care of. So we're going to take a break. It may be elongated a little bit. We got some sounds and beeps and burps, and our wonderful Rob Chacon is going to try to work on that. So we'll take a break. We'll be back and try to have a more streamlined edition of the Roundtable coming right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Rich Honan. Hopefully trying to take care of some of the sound issues. I know a lot of people are complaining about them. We're working on them. Just for the panelists, if you can just wait till I kind of call on you, that will help and not talk over. And that's just good form anyway, but also we can it helps us isolate each caller to find out which one is giving us problems. Thank you very much for that. Let us go to letters. We have many, so we will start and get to as many as we can. Neil says, how can you let people go back to work without having someone to watch the kids? I live near Kiryas Joel. Why is there no news about this small city and their health? I think there actually has been. I know we've even done stories here in WAMC. But as far as the larger question of how can you let people go back to work without having someone watch the kids, this does come down. We talked about this, I think, Tuesday, about schools, right? It all is going to come down to schools and colleges and whether they, when they reopen. Alan?
Yeah. Well, you know, obviously put yourself in the place of the president of SUNY at Albany or New Paltz or Skidmore and ask yourself this question. Are you going to be the guy or the woman who decides to open up your school and leave somebody in danger and get sued as a result of it? No, you're going to follow the instructions of the governor and others. You know, yes, it's a great problem for all universities. Nevertheless, I don't see any way out for them. Do you, Vera? You teach at
Well, I mean, universities, but also grade schools too. I mean, if you have kids at home and you have I think the point of the letter being, you keep the kids home, and now you're back to work because your state has opened up, and what do you do with the kids because they're home?
Joe, I'm going back to where I was. I'm simply saying you do what the governor tells you to do, period. That's the only way you can do it.
Yeah. So maybe I can say something about what some of the European countries are thinking about in terms of schools. I just spoke with my nephew, and then I have some friends in Switzerland and Austria, and there are a number of countries that are thinking of creating an entirely different school day where children might be able to go in small groups for instruction to the you know, to their school building and spread out in, you know, classrooms of like five students together with the teacher. And then they stay for only 2 or 3 hours and then the next group comes in. So every country and every region is trying to figure out how to get certain kids back to school, mostly those that have to do exams to move on to university for this spring. And they might extend school into the summer. Instead of having summer vacation, they might spread it out. So there are various ideas on how to get kids back into school at a certain point in very small groups. And of course, you know, a number of people are deeply concerned. Parents are wondering whether kids might bring back any virus to their home. Teachers are concerned in terms of how they're going to be prepared to protect themselves and their own families. But these are all discussions that are taking place in terms of how to effectively respond to this virus in the long run.
And Rosemary, go ahead.
Well, I would say that parents in this country are going to just hope for the best and send their kids when the government opens the schools again. They have somehow become content with the idea that their kids will be safe, even though we know that there's massive numbers of children shot in mass shootings every day in school. We just say, oh, my school is different. And I just didn't see kids going back. I don't see a massive change in the school year or the school date. And that would cause problems, too. People don't want their vacation interrupted. We've gotten very content. And I see most people just waiting for, as they put it, things to go back to normal.
Right. I just want to get, Rich, I want to get to that point, though, of this idea of what the letter writer was saying, that, okay, but if I can't leave my kids at home, they're young, I don't know what to do, and yet I'm being told I have to go back to work.
Yeah, and that's why I'm saying this is going to be split very sharply upon economic lines. You know, we could all talk as much as we want about, you know, telecommuting and things like that. But there's a huge community of people who have to physically be at work, and, you know, school provides, you know, not only an educational function, but for a lot of people, you know, a daycare type function. You know, you have young kids, you're not going to leave them at home, but you have to go to work. Now, the political or the governmental answer will be, look, if you're same as it is now, if you feel unsafe, then don't come in, which is fine to say. But then if you don't get paid when you don't come in, you know, where do you go? It's a tough interrelated problem. And like so many of them, it's going to fall much, much harder on, you know, the people with kind of non-white collar jobs.
Absolutely. Let's go to...
And what can we do about it? Well, then we have to have monthly payments from the government to sustain those families. Otherwise, it's not possible, right? Then we have children who are endangered, left alone by themselves, parents getting sick. I mean, this is so dramatic. We actually have to think about something that, you know, Andrew Yang discussed last year or, you know, increasingly, you know, or I mean, throughout this year as well. But last year, predominantly, when he was trying to run for or when he was running for a slot with the Democratic Party for president. So in essence, we need to have sustainable payments to families who cannot deal with all these challenges. And Rich is right. We can't. I mean, it's not going to work unless these families manage to pay their rent, manage to eat, and manage to keep their children safe. And their parents or grandparents who are living in the household possibly are protected and taken care of.
Let me go to some letters, try to get to as many as we can before the top of the hour. This is a subject line that says, Rich Honan, yay, the best, liveliest, and most thought-provoking people and, thought-provoking panels always have Rich. Thank you, Rich, for participating. As my throat seizes up. And thank you, WAMC. This is why I'm a member. When does the lockbox open? Oh, Steve, it's open. Oh, Steve, please, it's open. Do whatever you can do.
And the good news is that there is quite a bit of money coming in because people really love this radio station and want it. So not enough, of course, not to get anywhere near the $1 million we need so that we don't have to have a fund drive. We almost did that last time. But really, if everybody just does a little something, we'll be in great shape at WAMC.org. It's open. We love you, and we trust you, and we know that you know we can't continue without you.
Absolutely, and so important. And, let's see. Hillary writes, Michael Bloomberg could possibly tab healthcare workers being furloughed due to lack of elective surgeries for a knowledgeable group of people that could help with the COVID contact tracing. The temporary transitioning of this workforce could help avoid yet another group needing to apply for unemployment, and they could potentially work from home. Another group that could potentially help in this effort are the people all across the country that were lined up to work on the 2020 census. That from Hillary. Sean says, when will we finally have enough and remove this president? How many people need to die needlessly? How many small businesses need to be destroyed? When will Republicans and Democrats wake up and remember that they represent the American people who deserve a functioning, intelligent, capable government? Rich Honan, would you like to take that one?
I'm trying to understand. If you're going to blame him both for the people dying and for the businesses being shut, I see an inconsistency in that thinking. And
you can't have it both ways.
Yeah.
Barbara says, I have to say, I do feel really good about Michael Bloomberg taking the reins on the contact tracing operation. Anyone on that? Hearing none, I go to ahead, Vera, Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, you know, at least he has a track record in collecting data and analyzing it effectively and putting money into projects that he is interested in. So I think in terms of data collection and advancing scientific research, I think he is worthwhile leader for a project like that, like contact tracing, which is, you know, undernourished to say the least in this country.
Do you think he will use that information to finally blow the whistle on the lack of or inaccurate information that has come out of the Chinese government, which he has been unwilling to do in the past?
So here's the thing, Rich. We know that China has lied. We knew it pretty much all along. But you know what? Right now, we need to focus on figuring out what is going on in this country to save people's lives and prepare for the future. We know what the fact is about China. We know they are lying all the time. So why waste our energy right now on figuring out the same thing we already know? We can address those issues in terms of, you know, how to collaborate or not to collaborate with China in the future. But right now, we're trying to save American lives, we're trying to figure out our public health issues, and we're trying to figure out how to prevent a W curve in terms of a return of this virus and another collapse or a second layer to a collapse of the economy. So that is where our focus should be, laser-like.
So I reject this idea that we only have one focus and it's solving our problems now. I think that we ought to be looking into what happened with China and what happened with our own government and its lagging response. The problem is, Rich, that we did not rely on like China's pronouncements to figure out what was going on in China. We had intelligence that told us what was going on, and we had American operatives in the WHO who are saying to Americans high up in government, this is what's happening in China, pay attention. And that's the information that was ignored by Trump. So Trump is the problem, not Bloomberg.
Yeah, but we didn't have information as late as January 31st. You still have Anthony Fauci, who everybody agrees with, said, you know, we don't have enough information. You still through January, well, I'm not going to go through the whole litany of lies. But I really think that one thing that took us by surprise, while we never really trusted pronouncements that came out of the Chinese government, I think it really took everybody by surprise, including most of the people in the government, that they would lie so blatantly and so comprehensively about a world health issue. I don't think that's something that we expected them to lie that just that horrifically about. And, I mean, you know,
my question is why we wouldn't expect the Chinese to lie that much. During the avian flu, the World Health Organization sent its troops to Beijing 20 years ago, and what they discovered afterwards is then when World Health Organization public officials went to hospitals, in the meantime, the Chinese had loaded up their dying patients onto ambulances and drove them through Beijing so that the numbers of the dying and the affected would not be known by the World Health Organization. We know that's a pattern. Why would this pattern have changed?
Yeah, I agree with you.
Trump wants good relations and a trade deal with China, and he bent over backwards to put a good face on what he was saying in the face of what his own intelligence people, what even Azar was saying, was, listen, this is a big problem and we're not getting the full story. It was all here.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Vera Acarias-Kelly, and Rich Honan on the panel this morning. We welcome you, and we thank you very much. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Vera Acarias-Kelly, and Rich Honan make up the group. And we go back to letters. Doug says the frightening thing about unemployment numbers is the numbers are way higher than what is being reported. I've been trying to file for 6 weeks with New York State's Department of Labor. They hang up on you when you call. You get a blank screen when you log in online. I finally spoke with my state representative, said their office has been flooded with calls like mine, and that stimulus money, haven't gotten that yet either. That from Doug. Keith says, what the hell do you have to lose? Do you remember when Trump said, what the hell do you have to lose? We now know the answer. You can lose your life, your health, your job, your house. America elected a sociopathic sexually assaulting bankrupt casino owner. I am worried for America and my fellow Americans, says Keith.
Joe, I love that letter. And I wanted to say to Rich and to
the panel, go ahead.
Up until now. You know, we've been talking about the Chinese and the Chinese lying and the Chinese withholding information. But what about this guy? What about the president who sat on his fat behind and did nothing when he had a chance to do it, who lied to the American people and told us there were only 5 cases or 15 cases and we had licked it already? That's really quite something.
Rich.
So let's not leave it with China.
I think it starts and ends with China, but you know, I know this is not the forum to have that discussion. I do have to say, before I forget,
yes,
the music has been unbelievable during the breaks. I'm sorry that I'm not there because I'm just breaking out a series of moves.
You just dance.
It's
Soul Jazz Unit, and it's from their album Old School Recipes. And
it's excellent.
And people who want to find out more can go to our website and see the playlist, wamc.org/roundtable. Good way of diverting from China and the President, Rich. Okay. Robert says, has there been any thought of how the possible changes in jobs will affect property values? For example, if we determine more people can work from home, will people need to rent as much office space if people are working from home? Will it be more cost effective to rent a smaller space, a shared space, or only a space in a meeting room?
I know that there's been talk about on the commercial real estate side of shift to kind of like the post 9/11 shift to smaller cities, shifting operations to the point where you don't have, 1,000 people, on a campus where you're kind of shifting your operations.
Yep.
To cities that, a city like Albany, where you can do more effective social distancing than New York City. So there has been a lot of that talk, but he's right. That's going to affect you're going to be spending less money on office space net when all is said and done, if half of your staff is working from home.
And also, I just spoke with our real estate agent here in our area just to sort of have a conversation about what's going on for him. And he mentioned, of course, that home sales have come to a complete stop right now. He's hopeful that once we figured out a path forward that the inventory on the market will increase, but also he mentioned the issue of foreclosures. That is a beginning concern now in terms of people not being able to pay for or hold their homes. And so I suspect there will be a movement towards downsizing. And we certainly can't expect, from what I understand, to have an increase in our home prices. It might just stay flat or decrease in terms of home values.
Justin writes to us and says, I enjoy the shows where Rich is on the panel as he gives us an honest look at what people are thinking who may not agree with the views typically expressed on the panel. With that in mind, I'd like to hear Rich's opinion of the Trump administration's response thus far to the coronavirus outbreak. Which parts of the response does he feel have gone well? And are there parts of the response that he feels were mistakes or could have been done better? That is a great question.
Yeah, I think the worst part of the response has been the messaging. Sometimes in the substance, but you know, if you contrast, you know, Trump's presentations with the early presentations by Governor Cuomo, you know, certainly the Cuomo presentations from a messaging standpoint, I think, were much more, you know, kind of gave you more security. This is not, Trump is a guy who jumps around from issue to issue, you know, even within the same conversation, and takes several different positions within the same conversation, which for most of the time I can take, but in a situation like this, you know, you need more linear communication. So I think that's been the single, that's been the part that I have not liked. I have liked the regional response. I have liked the fact that he did, you know, he had been the one calling out, you know, China, not necessarily for this, but just that China has not been a great actor on the world stage. And I like that the one thing that he does that I always do like is he seems to, in the end, after lurching around, seems to end up relying on the right people. I think in relying on Fauci and Birx, I think that's been a real plus.
Rosemary, would you like to respond to that answer?
No.
I'll take a shot.
Go ahead, Alan.
I'll take a shot. Are you kidding? I mean, are you kidding? This president, because I've established over the years that he is a lying liar, continues to do that. So you say, well, in the end, he ends up, but he sends out messages one way or the other, Rich, that Fauci isn't long for this place, that he's going to fire Fauci. He fires his head person who is in the process of setting up some kind of remediation. This is a terrible man. I mean, terrible.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the whole question related to chloroquine, the whole, you know, the malaria medication that he touted as a possibility for treatment based on some narratives that were out there, not listening to his medical experts until very recently. Now he no longer endorses this medication because the first studies are coming out that seem to indicate that chloroquine is not helpful and may even be harmful to some of the patients that it's been, you know, used on, especially in terms of the veterans that have participated in this initial study. It's really deeply troubling for him as a president to announce such medications or mention their names when, in fact, we don't know if they work at all.
Georgia writes and says, Rosemary's statement that we need to look at the macro level was perfect. We need to restructure our whole way of doing things depending on perpetual growth rather than adaptability is the root of the problem.
Joe, I agree with that, but we're not going to do it. And we had the same, well, on a lower level, we had the same issue in 2008, excuse me, when the, you know, when we had the whole economic meltdown.
Yeah.
And Obama came in and, you know, a lot of us thought, you know, we're really going to restructure, you know, the financial system and the capital markets. We're going to reduce our reliance on debt. We're going to, you know, increase regulation in an effective way. And at the end of the day, whether it's, whether it's just because that's the market force or whatever, you know, we ended up basically recreating, you know, the same economy. It took us a while, but we ended up recreating it. And now we're still just as reliant, you know, when the capital market sees up and there's no borrowing and lending to be had, it still vastly affects our economy. So we always say that we should rethink things. And I think that we always kind of fall back into an old way of doing things. Now, maybe this is more massive than that.
I'm struck by what you're saying, because I agree with you, though, that you know, we say we want to do it, but will we do it? We probably won't. But is this different? I mean, I understand your of going back to 2008, but look, this is something that has impacted the entire world. And again, I want to preface this by saying I don't disagree with you. I'm just wondering about if you have to, looking at the macro, if you have to change everything, if you have to change the way that we put kids in dorms, if you have to change the way that we put kids in schools, if you have to change our department stores and our grocery stores and our cars and everything else as a result of this until a vaccine and a cure is found, and even if that's short term, that's still going to fundamentally change everything.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Rich, you first, and then we'll go to Vera. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not. It's only fundamentally changing something if you're actually going to change the underlying structure. I think, and to have an extreme dislocation, which is I hope what we're having, and then at some point we relocate. But no, we're not going to change the way kids go to school. We're not going to change the way people amuse themselves and entertain themselves. I think some fundamental things like the relocation of the global supply chain, which was already starting, I think it is going to start. And I think, by the way, that's going to be a huge economic upside. So, when we start moving supply chains out of China, I think that'll be helpful. But I don't think you can change things fundamentally. I don't think we want to.
Vera.
Yeah, so I was going to say something is very similar to Rich in terms of the global supply chain. I think we have seen disruptions that are permanent to the global supply chain. And while we hope that this country can replace all of the products that we usually get from the international market, we have so specialized in certain areas that our manufacturing industry is not ready to replace some of those necessary items that we would require to get our production up in the fall or in the spring or whenever we can actually open up again. So I'm not as confident as Rich that we are ready to replace the disrupted global supply chain, because we have been so specialized and we have not been prepared to replace all of the products that we have traditionally imported. The same will happen with a lot of other countries who are delayed now in terms of their ability to deal with this COVID virus, many issues related to food supply, replacement of our needs, other countries competing on the global market. I'm not so sure I feel we know clearly how we're going to replace what once existed with something new. That's what I'm worried about. I think we know what's destroyed, but I don't think we clearly have a plan in mind in terms of how to replace those supply lines.
Alan brought this up a couple of times, and I do want to get to it. The doctor who led the federal agency involved in developing a coronavirus vaccine said on Wednesday that he was removed from his post after he pressed for rigorous vetting of hydroxychloroquine, an anti-malaria drug embraced by President Trump as a coronavirus treatment, and that the administration has put, quote, politics and cronyism ahead of science. Dr. Rick Bright was abruptly dismissed this week as the director of the Department of Health and Human Services, Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, or BARDA, and removed as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response. He was given a narrower job at the National Institutes of Health.
God only knows what that narrower job is. In a scorching, in a scorching statement, here, play with these blocks. In a scorching statement, Dr. Bright assailed the leadership at the health department, saying he was pressured to direct money toward hydroxychloroquine, one of the several potentially dangerous drugs promoted by those with political connections, end quote, and repeatedly described by the president as a potential game changer. Alan.
Well, it's extraordinary. It's stupid. And it's typical of Trump. Open your mouth, let gas come out, let gas come out of that portal.
Yes.
And just lie, which he's doing. He had no business saying it. He had no scientific evidence of it, but he said it anyway. Disgusting.
Rosemary.
I was annoyed at him because when he was fired, reporters went to him and he did the demure, polite thing and just said, you know, differences of opinion and didn't say what was really going on and waited. And that has not worked for any of the people who have left the Trump administration under conditions like this. He says he's going to file a whistleblower report similar to the report that resulted in impeachment for Trump. That is not an avenue that worked either. The only thing that seems to bring this stuff out, and by stuff I mean dangerous subjugating of science and process to loyalty. If you're not loyal to Trump, if you go against what he wants, you're out, is going to the press. And I'm sorry he didn't do it faster. I'm glad he did it today. And Rich, I think I didn't get called on before, but I think that your comparison of coronavirus to the 2008 financial crisis is just not correct. I know that you always love to say Obama did it worse and he did it first, but it's inappropriate. This is a much different kind of crisis when you have the lives of your children at stake, when you have your jobs at stake, when you have the future of everything that we know in the country socially, not just financially at stake. People are going to bring more pressure. And so there may be a political willingness to change that we did not see in 2008. So,
well, I wasn't. And listen, look, oddly for me, I wasn't trying to blame the Obama administration. I was saying that's what I was trying to say. It was you know, the market. It's a kind of a glacial market force. What I will say, but really what would we change? What do we want to change fundamentally? We're going to want to change our preparedness, and I think we're going to do that.
I believe,
change our relationship with China, and we're going to do that. And I agree with Vera, that's a 10-year process, but I think we're going to do that. I think you're going to see a lot more of this where we're relying on friendly countries, either domestically or countries kind of within our orbit. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that.
Well, so, I mean, Rich, when you say friendly countries, we have to also make sure we actually treat allies in an appropriate manner. And this administration has clearly failed on establishing close connections or maintaining close connections with governments that had been allies and closely allied with the United States for decades. So this is an issue that has to be figured out for sure. But also, I think we need to reflect on our level of consumerism. I don't know that a consumer-based industry-based economy is the future as we have lived in the past. We might have to reflect on new ways intellectually to produce something that is needed in many other countries as well. So I think that's a potential area that we have to investigate rather than going back to purchasing and over-purchasing and producing garbage in vast amounts. I sort of realized myself, my house is full of stuff that I don't need at all. We all have, many of us, not all, many of us have things that we don't really need. And I've realized during this period how much of that I have and how much I need to give away.
Rosemary's ready to take it, Vera.
I'm ready. I love Scott.
Scott writes to us and says, a friend who lives in Atlanta told me that Planet Fitness will not be opening this weekend. He got an email from them saying they were not ready to open back up. On one hand, I'd like to think that they were going against the governor, but more likely it may just be that they got rid of all their employees and aren't ready to restaff by the weekend. I'm sure that will be a big problem for many businesses who let their employees go. How easy it is to rehire a full-time staff. How easy is it to rehire a full-time staff at a time like this, asks Scott. George says, here's my plan for opening up. I'm going to wait 2 weeks after Trump, Pence take their families to bars, restaurants, sporting events, etc. If none of them test positive for COVID at that time, I'll go out too. That's my idea of a testing plan. Tricia says, how can we open up when so few have been tested? Tests in Vermont have been very few. We don't even know if and where we can be tested. Governor Phil Scott has been a big disappointment. Dixie says, Alan, please relax. The bats transmitted it from their droppings to other animals, which people in China ate.
Yes, we've had a few bad people.
We have many bad questions.
Yeah,
yes,
we've had people who say, answers. "Don't pick on Alan. Don't pick on the bats."
Well, not picking on the bats. There's another one here that says,
"Don't pick on the bats."
They're okay. Yeah. They say, "Do the bats in my house have COVID? And can I get COVID from the bats?" This is from Alice in Warwick, and she says, "No, the virus that causes COVID hasn't been isolated from any of the UK's 17 resident breeding bat species."
Well,
doesn't that make you feel better, Alan?
No, not at all. You can believe anything you want to believe. If the news is filled with investigators are finding that bats were the original transmitters of the disease, I don't know if it's true or not. But I'll tell you one thing. I am so sorry. When a bat runs into this house, and, of course, I'm put in charge of getting rid of that bat, then it's quite worrisome when you read these reports. Yes, bat people, I get it. I get that you're concerned
Alan.
Yeah, you're concerned about your fellow bats. Yeah.
Yes. So here's the general rule: human beings.
Yes.
Human beings and wildlife should not be living in the same area, not close together, and some of those wet market issues are clearly a deep concern. So we know that
now China
animals.
Now, but we'll get back to China.
Carry viruses, right? Not only bats, but also pangolins and other animals that have been consumed and sold in these wet markets.
China says the wet markets don't exist.
Yes, and the original thing we heard was that it was not the wet markets, but it was the bats. Now, I don't know if that's true, but I have
No, the bats were sold at the wet market.
Yeah, the bat that they ate was sold at the wet market, apparently.
Oh, my goodness, they eat bats?
Yeah, that was the problem. That was the problem.
They used to make bat soup, and to make bat soup, you have to actually interact
use a bat
with the bat, kill it, and then cook it. And that's how that happened, apparently.
That's so interesting.
The key ingredient to bat soup, oddly, is a bat. And as if on cue, Bob writes about restaurants reopening. Rich may think that most restaurants should be able to reopen with safe spacing requirements. I have to think he's never been in a restaurant kitchen, most of which are cramped, overheated places where wearing masks will be agonizing. How can customers be safe if the employees are at constant risk?
Well, I think certainly the food workers are going to have to be. Now, that is an area where testing makes sense because it's a limited group and you can get answers you're going to have to, I think you might even have restaurants that advertise that say, we are testing our people. But at some point you have to start, you got to start letting people get back to work and let us be able to monitor what that risk is.
We got this from Tony, who says, I work on Broadway. How long do you think this multi-billion-dollar industry will be back? Once the state decides it's okay to go back, how long does it take for people want to gather? Spacing people apart in a theater is not financially viable. And this is why I was saying, this is what I was saying earlier about this idea of what we, of what we want to do and what we have to do. And the thought of that's going to have to be different, or at some point, if
are we just going to wait till we get a cure, or are we going to have to come up with a plan and say, okay, as Tony points out, that you're spacing people apart, and is that enough to get people? Are they going to, as Alan has indicated, you know, are they going to want to go back and do it?
Well, you know what, Joe, I'm not going back. Forget it. I'm not going to a movie ever again. I'm not going to the theater. Not that I like going to the theater, and there'll be 1,000 letters saying you're a fool. Nonetheless, you know.
You never know when a bat's going to come into the house.
But my question to you, Joe, is: are you going back? Because you're a real aficionado. Of the theater.
You know, I think this goes with every aspect of our life, right? I mean, I think it goes to schools, it goes to department stores, it goes to all the things that are closed now. Theater is certainly one of them. Going to a show, going to a concert, going to anything, and I guess I will feel comfortable going back when a responsible governor, maybe, you know, our governor, says it's safe and that the guidelines that were followed, that they have laid out have been followed. I think I would feel safe, or at least safer, going, and then I would take my own precautions. But I don't know. But it seems to me, and maybe I agree with the letter writer. I think we're a long way from that, though, aren't we?
So I think what the comparison is to terrorism. And we did go back, even though we know now public spaces are not as secure as we once thought they were. And it's a much less pleasant of experience. Going to the airport is an agony now because of TSA and the lines. And I think we're going to have something similar. Theaters will reopen again. And, yeah, it's economically unviable right now to space out seats. But to close them down entirely is even worse. So we'll space out seats. We'll have fever testing in and out before you can go in. We'll have all this again. It's just going to be different and probably unpleasant, but people need to congregate. It's something hardwired in them. We're not going to just stay home. We're not going to all be recluses forever.
And that also, let me just say, that also will be an economic driver, because things that Rosemary says are correct, and you're going to see people with kind of instant temperature tests and,
right,
you know, instant and you know, just, you know, the protective devices that, or protective clothing that maybe isn't as visible. And, you know, there's a startup company, not even startup anymore. There's a company here in Albany, one of our clients, that is using lighting to disinfect areas. And it was previously used by hospitals. They signed a contract with Delta. Delta's going to use the lighting in the planes to disinfect the planes. I think you're going to see a tremendous amount of innovation come out of this.
Vera, we got to take a break. I'll be right back with you. I promise. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue and we'll have our last go around. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Rich Honan, and Rosemary Armeo, I think, will be back, although according to my phone readout, she was dropped, so we have to figure out, maybe get her back. I don't know what happened there, but we'll figure it out, and hopefully she will be back with us in just a few moments. Peter says, Alan, twice in my firefighting career, I was called to remove a bat from a home. We used a CO2 extinguisher to flash freeze the bat, scoop them right up, and put them outside. In short order, they shook themselves off and flew away, none the worse for wear. So there you go. Call the fire department.
Cool. I bet that won't work. I bet that won't work anymore. as the old saying goes, the lady calls the fire department and says, there's a cat in my cat has climbed up the tree. And the fireman says, "Here, come down, lady. I've never seen cat bones in a tree yet." A little inappropriate, but okay.
And there you go. Rosemary, are you back?
I'm back. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much. All right. Edward says, question for anyone supporting this president and his party at this point. So I think this is for you, Rich. let me just pre-read it.
That's great that you have to do that.
Okay. Basically asking, where is your breaking point? How can you support a president and party putting Americans at risk during this pandemic? The question being, there's a lot of preface to it about the Klan and so forth. But the basic question is, do you have a breaking point when it comes to the guy?
Sure, but we just fundamentally disagree with you guys. We do not believe he is putting Americans at risk. We believe China put Americans at risk. We believe he was blowing the whistle on China. I'm glad to see that all of you have gotten the talking points straight, where now I guess we're not even trying to defend China. We're all saying that we should have always known that China was the problem, even when a lot of the outlets were calling Trump racist when he stopped the flights, the immigration from China. But no, I'm not.
We're glad you guys got the talking points about helping people out who are in need.
Well, I think that, but we're doing that as well.
Or what happened in the original, or what happened when he found out about it and did nothing about it for a couple of months, and put every American at risk. Come on.
You know, Alan, as late January, the Chinese were still telling us there was no human to human transmission. Okay.
I guess we don't have a CIA. I guess we don't have anybody who knows what's going on. We had to depend on what they were telling us. Come on.
I wish we had a House Intel Committee. Who's ahead of
this
that?
This guy's a creep.
Can I just say, even within the Trump administration, appointees, there were warnings to him about the danger of this virus, including from Navarro months ago. And he said this is a very serious pandemic and it might actually have terrible repercussions for our economy. And he mentioned in the report, I think if I remember correctly, possibly hundreds of thousands, if not up to a million dead. That was within the Trump administration just about, I think, 6 weeks ago or 8 weeks ago. And he didn't.
Yeah, and Rich, it wasn't his stopping flights to China that got him labeled as a racist. It was calling it the Chinese flu, and it's not. It originated first in Wuhan, but it's no more Chinese than the 1919 epidemic was Spanish.
Issue related directly to encouraging some of his followers to attack Asian Americans or not stopping them from targeting Asian Americans. And that was a profoundly disturbing and racist issue. And I have a number of Asian Americans who were poorly treated, spat at, and let's just say feel that they are being targeted because certain members of society blame them as if there's a genetic predisposition to spreading a virus when you're Asian in general.
All right. Rich, go ahead. You're starting to say something.
No, I'm good. Go ahead.
Okay. Rosemary, were you going to say something?
Well, I was just going to add to what Vera said. I mean, you didn't even have to be Chinese to be subject to harassment. You could be Asian of any sort, South Korean or Indonesian even was what they were getting harassed to. Singaporean friends were harassed on the street in New York. Crazy, crazy stuff. And Trump's behavior, if it doesn't encourage it, it certainly condones it.
All right, let's go back to the letters. We have many, and we only have a few moments left. We go to, I'm going to skip the bat letters. We got a lot on the bats. Jeffrey said, according to Atlantic Magazine, everyone in Hong Kong wears masks, but they did not shut down the society. There have only been four coronavirus deaths. What proof is there that the draconian measures are superior to lesser ones, which wouldn't cripple our republic?
You know, I read about that.
I love this.
What they're
in
doing
Las Vegas, did you read about? Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I hope you're going to talk about the mayor of Las Vegas.
I love the mayor of Las Vegas says, hey, we'll be the control group. No social distancing. We'll open up everything. And we'll just see how many people die. So you got your comparison. We can find out if social distancing really works. Lovely.
She reminded me of a character from the Carol Burnett show. I was watching her and just, I think at one point just Anderson Cooper put his face in his hands. He didn't know what to do.
There are some people speculating that she had been drinking. I don't know about that.
Well, I can tell you, I was drinking after watching her.
I mean, she basically volunteered her population, especially those who are economically more vulnerable for human experimentation. So it was quite disturbing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And her answer to it was, well, I don't own a casino. Okay.
Right. In other words, the government's not responsible for setting any guidelines. Let the private industry experiment. I'm like, wow.
Betsy writes to us and says, let's not forget that any changes in the public schools for reopening include size of classes, changes in schedules, yep. Must first filter yep. through the teachers' unions. These unions mm-hmm. are the most powerful lobbyists in the state government. They must feel comfortable with what happens to their thousands of members with reopening, or it doesn't happen. To Sean, who says, what the heck is Rich trying to say? Stop with the China nonsense. Of course, we all know that they lie for the past several decades. That's not the point. The point. This is the most dangerous president in the history of the country. We are code red. The warning lights, blinking for months, have now become permanently turned on. Trump is now an existential threat to the people of the United States of America. He outwardly encourages liberty for states where governors have ordered stay-at-home orders. Do you want me to move on, Rich, or do you want to respond to that?
Move on.
Okay. Dave says, does China lie? Probably. Does Trump? Absolutely. Do I trust what comes out of the White House? Hardly. Every time someone in this administration speaks the truth, he is canned. Let's take care of what we do before criticizing other countries. 3 minutes, and I can get in a bunch of letters, I think, if we go fast. And that is, don't send links. Thank you. I'm concerned that Rich and others, like governors and Trump, are advising people to decide for themselves if they feel safe in places like restaurants. This is a public health emergency. It can't be solved, and most likely will be exacerbated by individuals deciding if they feel safe and then later getting sick and wanting to sue someone. No one will take the blame. And more will die. The economy will only suffer from this type of unscientific, non-public health attitude. That from Betsy. Gordon says, has anyone noticed that when Trump is standing to the side at his press briefings while someone else is speaking, he appears to close his eyes frequently? Sleepy Donald? As if he is falling asleep, and then he catches himself and jerks himself awake. Just watch a video. I'm not making this up. Okay. I don't know. I watched the briefings. I haven't noticed that. Carol says, so what pharmaceutical company produces hydroxychloroquine, and which of Trump's cronies are associated with that company, or does Trump himself have stock in that company? Follow the money. I think that there have been many investigations of that. Have there not, Rosemary? But we haven't gotten anything definitive, is my understanding.
There have been. He owns a small part in one company that makes one of them. Notice he has not spoken the name, nor have any Foxos spoken the name of those drugs since the tests have begun to come out showing that not only are they not helpful, but actually could be harmful when given to many people.
Quickly, from Chris, who said a promising test is a simple finger clamp that determines oxygen level in the blood. My doctor, Dr. Lemansky, said you should get one. I think we all should. He says it's a very good test of whether you got it or not.
All right. Alan, I can't hear you very well. If you can just, I don't know if whatever.
If I get closer
there
to
you
the
go.
Microphone.
Okay, good.
It's amazing
okay.
how that works.
Okay, all right. I didn't. So just say what you said again because I didn't
okay,
hear it.
Okay, yeah. If you get an oxygenator, you know, one of those things you put on your finger, that's the way he's able to judge whether or not somebody promisingly has this disease.
Sanjay Gupta was talking about those last night and had one very fascinating. I was watching that being done. Okay, we're out of time. My thanks to everybody. It is very nice to have you all here. My thanks to Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Vera Acarius-Kelly, and Rich Honan. Thank you all. We'll be back right after this.